Happy Bitcoin Wednesday, freaks. It's your boy Odell here for another Citadel Dispatch. I know it's been a month. I hope you've been enjoying the other content, the external content I've been posting to the feed. There's a lot of great conversations in there. I've been quietly working behind the scenes on a bunch of different projects. I haven't forgotten about you all. I was hoping that we were going to get to do I was kind of holding out, wanting to do more in-person rips in our new studio in Nashville at Bitcoin Park, but been dealing with some family things. All is good on that front. I should be back in Nashville sometime soon. But in the meantime, we're going to rip some remote conversations to keep it going, and because I missed you all. With all that said, Citadel Dispatch, as you freaks know, is a show focused on actionable discussion. It is a live show with active chat participation. I appreciate all the freaks who join the chat. It's also an ad-free, sponsor-free, value-for-value show that's 100% funded by the audience. There's a lot of haters out there right now that say audience funding cannot work, that the ad model is the only way to go. I appreciate you all helping to prove them wrong. The amount of support I get from you freaks is truly incredible. It is really cool seeing the sats flow directly into my Lightning node. The easiest way to support the show is through podcasting 2.0 apps such as Fountain Podcasts, Breeze Wallet, EchoLN.com, and Podverse.fm. You simply load the app up with some sats, search Citadel Dispatch in the app, press subscribe, choose how many sats per minute you think the show is worth, and it will automatically send those sats directly to my node as you listen. There's also a feature called Boostergrams. Boostergrams allow you to attach a message to a single payment. Basically, you can think of it as a global message board comment section with payments included. It's great to see the freaks supporting that way as well. I'm able to, all of us are able to read them, but I do read the top four from the previous episode. Since Dispatch hasn't gone for a month, I will be reading multiple of them in a second. But before I get there, you can also support by going to CitadelDispatch.com. I have a BTC Pay server there. You can support using on-chain or Lightning. I have a BIP47 reusable payment code and a pay name attached to that. That pay name is Odell. All of this is listed at CitadelDispatch.com. And I know it is a bear market. If you do not have sats to support the show, you can obviously support Dispatch by sharing it with your friends and family or subscribing in your favorite podcast app, YouTube, Twitch, Twitter. It's on all the platforms, Rumble, Bitcoin TV. Just search Citadel Dispatch. Share it with your friends and family. It is appreciated. Okay. I actually nailed that pretty good considering we haven't done this in a month. I am going to read select boostergrams from the freaks. We had CD77 was an awesome Dispatch conversation that was focused on Silent Link. We have Eric99 contributed 50,000 sats. He said, stay humble and stack sats. Really great advice, Eric. We had Vake saying, very helpful episode. Thanks. The intro music is weirdly soothing. Thank you, Vake. He contributed 14,000 sats. Previously, we had the Adam Back episode, CD75, which I really enjoyed that conversation. We had Nate Johnson contribute 50,000 sats saying, this show is invaluable. I appreciate all you do for the space. Hope your family is okay. Thank you, sir. I appreciate that. I also was putting the Bitcoin.review episodes that I was doing with NVK on the Dispatch feed before he told me I wasn't allowed to do that anymore. And we had letter 6173 with 7,777 sats saying all signal and zero noise, amazing show. Last but not least, I put my Bitcoin Amsterdam 2022 conversation on the feed, which you freaks seem to appreciate. And we had Mallard Quackenbush contribute 50,000 sats saying free Ross. We had Cryosats contributing 25,000 sats saying fight the good fight, hashtag Cryosats. So cheers. Oh, wait, this one's even better. Got to read this one. And we have at Stimmy with 21,000 sats saying fuck FATFA and fuck Circle 2. So on that note, we will continue to the show. I appreciate all you freaks. We have a great conversation lined up. It's actually one of the conversations that I was really excited to have in person. We tried to make it happen in person, but unfortunately we weren't able to. So we have the PlebLab crew from Austin on the show today, and we're going to have a really great conversation about PlebLab. We'll start with, we have Thriller X Carr, my former producer and partner in crime over at Rabbit Hole Recap. How's it going, Carr?
Hey, how's it going, Matt? Thanks for having me on the show.
Carr is also the co-founder of PlebLab, hence this conversation. And then we have another co-founder of PlebLab, Kyle, at the Bitcoin Bum. How's it going, Kyle?
It's going all right, my dude. How about yourself?
Very good. Very good. I'm excited for this conversation. It's good to be back on air with Dispatch with y'all. And we have John, who is the founder of Zaprite, a company that is based in Austin and works out of the PlebLab. How's it going, John?
It's going great. Stoked to be here.
Thanks for joining us. So with all that said, I mean, I think the best way to start this conversation is, what is PlebLab?
Yeah, great question. I think it's been an interesting journey over the past year, kind of really trying to figure out ourselves what the answer to that question is. But plain and simple, we are a pleb-driven accelerator program for the Bitcoin era.
I love it. So I have the title of this episode is Building a Bitcoin City with PlebLab. Austin has obviously become has some kind of magnetic pull for Bitcoiners. It has become one of the predominant Bitcoin cities of the world, let alone America. Obviously, PlebLab has been, and your crew over there has been playing a key role in that. Like, how do you think about your role in Austin and how that, you know, how that affects the PlebLab strategy as you guys build out here?
It's kind of fluid. It changes day to day, month to month. A lot of things in the space move really quickly and changes happen fast. So we try our best to kind of stay flexible and make the changes that we need to when we need to. I think early on when honestly, pre-PlebLab, when we started the Austin Bitcoin Club, the idea was just like a bunch of us seemed to be arriving in the city. There was only kind of like one time and place per month where everybody was actually getting together, which was at the time the BitDevs over at Unchained Capital. And we launched Austin Bitcoin Club with just kind of a selfish desire to get together with Bitcoiners more often. And the more often we hung out with the Bitcoin scene and the people that were arriving and the people that were deciding to stay, the more we realized there was just kind of like an unanswered question. The bat signal was out there saying, if you're a builder, come to Austin. But the question that wasn't answered was like, what's next? And we just basically tried to keep answering that question. It was like, what's next? That what's next after getting a group of people together seemed to be finding a way to get developers together on a more regular basis. And that grew into what we call PlebLab today.
I guess like since I have you, Kyle, your personal story, you were drawn to Austin and Bitcoin kind of at the same time, right?
Yeah, it happened pretty fast. I mean, I learned about Bitcoin in 2016, but really, really, really briefly. And it was not a thing that I like went deep down the rabbit hole with at that time. I spent 4 years on kind of a spiritual journey around the world. And everywhere I went, I just kept meeting random people that would that would discuss Bitcoin with me, kind of diving into several hours long conversations, kind of piecing my understanding of it together. I didn't get skin in the game until June or July of 2020 during the pandemic, kind of towards the tail end of the madness with the stock market after the crash. And shortly after I got into it, I realized that I came to the conclusion that Bitcoin played a pivotal role in producing the most peaceful possible transition of power. And post-military, I had always had this feeling that some type of revolution was imminent. So once I realized that I had found kind of like a premier puzzle piece for that transition, I basically ended up going all in. While visiting some family in Dallas, I heard whispers in the wind about this scene that was happening in Austin. I came down, I saw 125 Bitcoiners in the Unchained space with no masks on, and I just never left.
Love it. And I guess, John, you kind of have a similar story, right?
Yeah, exactly. I was initially drawn to Austin because of Bitcoin Twitter, obviously, probably like a lot of us. It was just so much like signal on there about what's going on in Austin. And I was in Canada. Actually, funny enough, I'm back here right now. But I was in Canada at the time, and I was kind of just like living up in the mountains, kind of like away from society and, you know, not really kind of had much interaction with Bitcoiners at all, other than kind of working on this little hobby project and trying to like reach out to people. And so when I kind of left and just decided to do a little bit of traveling, I landed down in Austin, and just immediately the difference was just massive. Like, you could sense it like straight away that there was something like, you know, really crazy, like bubbling up in Austin. And so, yeah, right from the start, it just started to, you know, everything just started to kind of snowball for me personally, just because of people like meeting Kyle and Carr and Keon and the guys at Pleb Lab and Austin Bitcoin Club. It just offered this amazing like place to get together and chat to people and figure out what was going on. I think there was like a BitDevs like 3 days after I arrived in Austin or something. And I remember going into the old Unchained office, and it was like a sweat box, and it was like 250 people in there, and like, you couldn't really talk to anybody, and then you're going out for barbecue afterwards, and it's like, you know, it's great, but it's kind of hard to have these like, you know, deeper conversations. And then I went to like the Austin Bitcoin Club, and that was just way more casual and much more like kind of chill. And that's where I met so many different people. I could have like, you know, more kind of like, you know, longer, deeper conversations. And then obviously, like after a couple of days, like I met Kyle, and you know, we started talking about his idea for Pleb Lab and things like that. And then it kind of like grew from there. But yeah, just immediately, like once you land in Austin, you can immediately sense that there's something going on. And it's in no small part to these guys here, obviously.
Yeah, I mean, it's extremely impressive what you all have built over there. I mean, obviously, we've been taking a lot of inspiration for that in Nashville with Bitcoin Park and just the community initiatives we have. I mean, you mentioned BitDevs. We've been doing for the last year, we've had a very strong meetup scene in Bitcoin meetup scene in Nashville, but we finally launched proper BitDevs. I was, you know, I'm formerly from New York, where we had the OG of BitDevs. So I have a lot of respect for BitDevs. And I was one of the proponents that like refused to launch one until we were, you know, set to do it the right way. But we have our second BitDevs ever is going to be tonight at Bitcoin Park. So if you are in the Nashville area, you should consider going. Carr.
Hey, Odell. Just before I get lost in there, man, there's a comment from Not Leo at Pleb Lab. Are you also a contact for international plebs randomly passing through Austin? Yes, for sure. Reach out to us. You can hit us on the Twitter handle at Pleb Lab, or feel free to reach out to any of the founders and shoot us a DM. We're always looking to work with cool people who are swinging through Austin.
Awesome. Not Leo said that in our Matrix chat, which anyone can join at CitadelDispatch.com. If you click that Citadel chat button, the Matrix chat is extremely active. We have over 1,000 Bitcoiners there constantly talking about really cool things. It is obviously broadcast live during Citadel Dispatches, but conversation happens there 24/7, 365. So consider joining. Self-hosted, end-to-end encrypted. Not that you really have any privacy in a group chat, because any one of those 1,000 people could be spooks. We probably have at least 12 spooks in the chat. Carr, you left me at Rabbit Hole Recap to do Pleb Lab full time.
Sorry.
How's that going?
It's going good. One of the things that I realized, doing Rabbit Hole Recap and working with Marty is just like the amount of just media knowledge that I learned from y'all, and then just how to conduct yourselves in the Bitcoin space. I think most importantly, I also learned like the work ethic that you guys have. But it was amazing to see it on a daily basis with Marty, and kind of understand like what it takes to actually run a company and be successful at it. I think for me, like starting out that way and doing it that way was like the best way to get into the Bitcoin space. I just got extremely lucky, extremely blessed. It got to a certain point, like once we moved into the lab, it was kind of obvious to me that there was absolutely no way I could do both jobs to the greatest of my ability anymore. And I think that was like the main reason to focus entirely on Pleb Lab. Was to give everything to it, just like I had given everything to like TFTC, So, yeah.
And you also took away from well, first of all, I wanted to say I'm very excited for you guys. Obviously I miss you at Rabbit Hole Recap, but I was very happy when you told me the news. You also took away from TFTC your love of borderline trademark infringement, since all of your shows that you guys seem to be launching out of Pleb Lab have the same acronyms as popular shows, just coincidentally.
I think that has more to do with showing how all these fiat companies are not going to exist anymore once Bitcoin kind of becomes a standard. And it's just like sending a message, that's how I look at it. I don't know if that's how the rest of the guys look at it, but it's more about like kind of sending a message to the fiat establishment that we're coming.
Hey, Matt, you also brought this up at the meetup in Nashville, and I had a very similar answer back then. I kind of joked around, but honestly, after we left Nashville, it dawned on me that, to be honest, we just kind of copied you guys. You really inspired that from the beginning with TFTC, the first copyright infringement among this.
Yeah, so. That is true. I didn't think about that. Yeah, Marty.
I don't know what you're talking about. TFTC is a completely unique name that was just thought of. Thought of randomly one day.
I saw the shirts, Matt. I saw the shirts.
we're on this tangent. So like, how do you, obviously Pleb Lab is a physical community space. But you guys also have all this content. And in Nashville, we've been implementing a relatively similar strategy. We often call it locally produced, globally distributed, where you're building local community and in-person events, but also at the same time, you're producing content that is distributed around the world. How do you guys, how does that fit into the, and how do you guys think about that when you're thinking about the Pleb Lab strategy?
I personally look at it like really simply, and it's, I kind of got it more from the devs than anybody else. It's just like building in public. You're seeing the Legends of Lightning guys do that. I was able to talk to Johns a couple of times before they launched that, and he had a lot of questions about that. And I told him, it was like, it's like all the other guys that are rubbing off on us here inside the lab, all these other devs that build in public. Mind you, a lot of them are NIMs, but there's something to be said about, pushing code up to GitHub and everybody seeing everybody verifying it. So that's kind of how the way I look at it. And then the other thing, just from like a Pleb Lab perspective, is just the amount of people you can inspire, right? It's how many other labs are being created because they see us here in Austin doing what we're doing. And I think that's another thing that's really important, is showing people that there is a light out there and we can break through it just by these little pieces of media that go out to the masses.
That building in the open comment is really interesting because, I mean, I've personally taken a lot of influence from our open source community. You know, I came to the realization years ago, basically after the Snowden leaks, that our only shot at freedom and sovereignty was the open source movement, Bitcoin and the greater open source movement. And since then, I've kind of tried to model everything I do off of that movement. And it's super interesting how it is obvious in open source developer culture, the way they do things. But when you try and model it for other things, people think you're crazy. So like for Citadel Dispatch, it's live, it's unedited, it has uncensored live chat that anyone can participate in. I don't have ads or sponsors. It's completely funded via donations of our audience. People think that's crazy. OpenSats, you know, is 100% pass through. We don't take a salary out of it. We pass all any funds donated are passed to, you know, directly to open source contributors. People think we're absolutely crazy for that. Why don't we take a 5% VIG off of all donations like all the other nonprofits do? So it should be interesting watching this, you know, new generation as this open source movement gets stronger and stronger, kind of take that similar model and implement it on various different initiatives. I think it could be very significant. I think people are really underestimating how powerful that model is.
I think this like open source modeling, it comes up a lot, especially as we are like really getting more and more focused on working with startups and the real kind of challenge of finding the balance between open source and actually earning an income with that open source kind of ethos. And I think the balance is really important to touch on because open source is important. Like PlebLab has kind of been open source since the very beginning. Anybody that has reached out asking like how we've done what we've done, like how are we structuring it? I've given everything I have to anybody who's asked. But I also think it is important to note that if you are out there and you're looking at trying to start a company, but you're trying to keep it on an open source model, there's something to be said about timing and figuring out how all of that works, because it is true that open source is great. Like information being free is great. Like let the best man win. But I think at the same time, like people who are trying to grow out this ecosystem, the people who are inspired to build, it's important that they are meeting their own kind of needs, right? Like it's very difficult to help anybody else if you are not first taking care of yourself. If you find yourself in a place where like you have no financial worries at all and you can just free and open source everything right from the get-go, I think that's great. I think keeping some things close to your chest in the early days is also a completely valid approach, because like if you're starving and you can't keep a roof over your head and you can't like put food in your family's belly, like you can't really help anybody else out either. So
yeah, and too, Matt, also like when we had that that panel talk at UT about a couple weeks ago, this was a question that they asked in the room. Like these graduate students were asking us like, well, why would I go and create on Bitcoin if it's open source? Like how do I make that into a startup? And I think John and Keon had like really great answers. John, do you remember what exactly you told them?
I don't remember exactly what the answer. I think my answer, because I think you guys all thought that Zaprite was open source, so I got like caught up in that. I think my answer was more that like instead of going the open source route, which you know Zaprite probably will eventually. Like I'm a huge fan of open source, and I definitely want to have like at least you know a Start9 or Umbral app or something you can run on your node that will be like just completely open source. You can pull it down and run it. That will definitely come eventually. But I think my answer in that panel in UT was more to do with the fact that I'm focusing on the self-custody aspect of it, is that, you know, that's my kind of important goal, at least now in the early stages as operators, just to build the tools that allow for people to keep doing self-custody rather than trying to build a custodial model and have it like open source. You know, if you're promoting self-custody and you're building the tools that allow for self-custody, then the open source part is important, but it's not as important, right? Because we're not actually like custodying funds or doing anything that could like take anybody's money. But still, you know, it would be good to actually show the code that's running underneath it. But yeah, it's a huge aspect of building. And I love to see it, particularly in the Bitcoin ecosystem. There's a lot of it. And it's definitely, you know, viable. Look at what Keon is doing at Stacker News. Like, it's definitely an option to build. There's so many open source companies out there that are thriving. So it's great to see.
Is Stacker News open source?
Yeah.
Yeah, completely.
Yeah.
So just so for the freaks, yeah. Stacker News is founded by the third co-founder of PlebLab, who unfortunately couldn't join us, Keon.
I was going to say, Matt, yeah, I was going to say that's the thing that I realized early on was just from talking with Keon is like, there's a way to do it. Like, there's a way to do both. It's a fine line to walk, but it can be done. And it's just like keeping the IP, the whether it's the Web of Trust or whatever algorithm that he's implementing on the back end, like maybe that's the stuff that he keeps close to the chest and everything else is open source. We're going to have him do a Web of Trust workshop here in a couple of weeks. So we'll be able to see kind of how all that works. But I know he was talking to Carvalho a lot when he was kind of developing that. So I think there is something to it. It just has to be done in a very careful and obviously fine line way. So.
Tony's asking where the source is, but we can just let him go look for it. Oh, good. Sad Sale told him where it is.
Yeah, it's interesting. Actually, I mean, like, the trust stuff is probably not. I can understand if that's not fully open sourced, but the rest of it is absolutely. Yeah,
that's look. I mean, it depends. It depends on what type of company you're running and a bunch of different nuances. And there's, you know, one of our favorite things to do on Dispatch is argue about open source licensing because there's so many different licenses you can use. In Stacker News's case, I think is a perfect example of something where the most value of it is accrued to the brand and the network effect of the brand. So yeah, like if I have the source, I can go and create my own version of Stacker News. But unless like he absolutely fucks up management of stacker.news, like that's going to be where the majority of users are. And a site that has more users in that context is a more useful tool. So, I actually think that's a perfect example where, you know, you can have your cake while also you can monetize relatively easily, while also providing the source, And then there's basically two arguments for why open source is important. One is the FOSS argument, which is free and open source software, just high level here, just to get this out here since we're talking about it, where you're actually allowing anyone to take the code, change it, don't change it, distribute it, sell it, brand it however they want, do whatever they want with the code. That's extremely helpful from a censorship resistant and robustness of the movement point of view, because it means that this code is viral. It doesn't die with any individual or company and will outlive us all. And then you have the source viewable licenses, which many will argue is not fully open source because it isn't. And those licenses basically say you can't do anything with the code. This is to the extreme. You can't do anything with the code. But you can view it and you can inspect it and you can verify it. And that becomes very important when you're talking about sensitive activities, stuff like encrypted messaging, stuff like managing Bitcoin secrets, Bitcoin private keys, and being able to verify that even though the service is saying it's encrypted or even though the service is saying your keys are secure, that's actually the case and they're not doing some funny business there. So those are the two main reasons why open source is important. And it's up to, you know, individuals and companies to decide how that fits in their model. But I think it is mostly a myth that you can't monetize on open source. I think people just, it might be a little bit more difficult. But ultimately, it can be significantly more powerful when you get there. And it doesn't have to be right away. Like there shouldn't be necessarily a rush right in the beginning to do it. But it should ideally be on most people's radar, especially if they're building Bitcoin tools. What were you saying, Carr?
I was going to say it's one of the things that he's always hit home with me on since I met him last year, like in the early days before Stacker News, like really, really launched. And just hanging out with him and talking with him every day and spending time with him, I've come to realize he's been right on a lot of things over time. And what I try to do at PlebLab is really focus on the users. It goes back to his ethos of like focusing on the users and making sure that they're happy. And what do you need to do to make sure that the user base increases, and what do they need? And I think for us at PlebLab, I think we're talking about this open source model and how that can influence a lot of these labs being built. And I think that's one of those things that I really hit home on, is that if we focus on the users, if we focus on the devs inside the space, I think we'll be successful doing it. I don't think it's as hard as people think. I think Keon has proved over time that when you build a platform like a Stacker News or even in the real world, like an ABC or a PlebLab, this can be done if you focus on the people inside the lab, inside the club, inside the platform. So just want to throw that out there.
So we have Rissa Labs in the comments on Matrix. They are asking, is PlebLab a place for non-technical plebs too?
Yeah, I saw that question, and then it got lost in time. But the answer is yes, in some regards. So desk space on like a day-to-day basis is extremely limited due to just the kind of nature of the size of the space and the amount of money I have to spend on desks. That being said, outside of our kind of day-to-day co-working, where we are kind of hyper focused on technical folks, adding kind of mind space to the the co-working space acts as a synergistic kind of side to our accelerator program. That being said, we do have a lot of things that we do. We have our PBS, we have our weekend kind of low level technical workshops that we do on Saturdays. There's a lot of things that we do that are open to like non-devs and non-technical folks as well. So yes, the answer is yes and no.
Okay. Shall we go back to your comment about, you know, building you mentioned wrestling with open source when it comes to helping startups in the space at PlebLab. I mean, we have John here. John, like, how does Zaprite, how did PlebLab help with you building out Zaprite, and how do you hope to see them go forward as they like kind of more formalize, working with builders directly?
Well, for me, I kind of touched on it a little bit earlier about, you know, I kind of came down into Austin and wasn't really, you know, didn't have much connection with the Bitcoin community, even though I'd been in Bitcoin for like quite a while before I started Zaprite. But one of the things, you know, that immediately helped was just the fact that they were running Austin Bitcoin Club, and I could just meet up and have very social interactions with other Bitcoiners. So that was like just immensely helpful, just from getting into a new city and like, you know, making new friends and meeting people and figuring out the lay of the land. But very quickly, I think within a couple of days of being in Austin, I met Kyle and we chatted about his idea for PlebLab. And I think he kind of offered me the first like desk in there to kind of come in. And that was huge, because it just gave me like this co-working space to kind of like sit and start thinking about Zaprite on a deeper level and figure out, okay, well, like, you know, this seems to be something here. There's a lot of people who are like excited about it, thinking about it. I should think about setting up a company. How do I do that? Of course, these guys had like, you know, plenty of contacts that they had made from their couple of months of already like hosting events in Capital Factory in Austin. So there was plenty of people to reach out to about that. And then as more and more developers like started to come in, you know, it was just amazing to be able to sit in the same like small little office around other like well-known, well-respected like Bitcoin developers. And then, of course, other founders came in, Michael from Oshi, you know, a bunch of other people. And that on a personal level, that just helped me so much because it just got me to think. I'd never started a company before. So it got me to think about how, you know, founders think about different things, what's important, like what you should be kind of focusing on. And then, of course, there was just the massive amount of like community events and things that they were running, like Block Party and things like that, that were just exposing Zaprite and Bitcoin in general to like just a huge audience, which was, of course, you know, putting more of a spotlight on what was happening in Austin, which then attracted like VCs. And there was so many different like VCs and people passing through Austin. And then I just got to have so many more of those meetings. And then, of course, like formed a company and started raising money. And all of that, I think, was like, you know, not possible until I came down to Austin and met with these guys and like kind of just like landed on their springboard and basically was able to just, you know, piggyback on all of the proof of work that these guys were putting in. I think it just accelerated Zaprite's like journey immensely. And my own personal one as well. I made so many amazing friends in Austin. Like, it's unbelievable. But yeah, I mean, in terms of helping Zaprite, just general marketing events, like community events, different things, that were constantly happening, hackathons, workshops, like sponsorships, just really, really good stuff to get the word out there, about Zaprite, and was like hugely beneficial, especially in those early days.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like I've known you for a decade, but it's probably closer to a year. I think we were introduced through Carr.
I think actually it was probably earlier than that. I think through Vivek from Blockstream, right? We jumped on a video.
Oh, it was Vivek because you had Liquid support.
Yeah. So I remember
Vivek's also a mainstay of the Austin community.
Yeah, Vivek's awesome. Yeah.
Call, you were doing that from the old Pleb Lab, I think.
Yeah, that first call we jumped on was just in the Capital Factory, the old Pleb Lab. Yeah.
The new space is awesome.
Yeah, it's great. Yeah. So yeah, I think from that, and then I think Carr introduced me to Marty, obviously, like being in Austin, and you know, got on great with Marty and was just able to kind of tell him a lot more about what Zaprite is trying to do and the bigger vision and stuff. And then obviously like jumped on more calls with you guys and
Tony. We have Tony in the comments, another ride or die freak, saying someone uses Liquid ? I think that was the conclusion of our talk is that nobody uses Liquid.
I see Tony using Liquid all the time inside of Pleb Lab. What is he talking about?
Well, the funniest part is everyone was freaking out yesterday about the L&D bug, which made all the L&D nodes fall out of sync. But by the way, freaks, there's going to be a dispatch very shortly on that topic. It's going to be great. So if you're not subscribed on the podcast feed, make sure you subscribe to that. But everyone was talking about the L&D bug. And meanwhile, if the Liquid Twitter account had tweeted out that they were having issues as well, I don't think anyone would have noticed.
At least they're on.
Is Tony not building Liquid Sploit? No?
Yeah, Tony, when Liquid Sploit?
He's doing Hacker News Sploit first.
Hacker News. Yeah, now that he has the source. So Kyle and Carr, to build on what John said, I mean, obviously Pleb Lab was very early then. Those were just, you know, kind of knock-on effects of the community building that you guys are doing in Austin. Like, how do you look at supporting companies, you know, in a stronger way going forward? Like, what do you build on top of that early, very positive experience that John just shared?
Yeah, I mean, so here's the thing is like, when we launched Pleb Lab, as I kind of touched on much earlier on, it was really just a community of people that showed up to our Austin Bitcoin Club that had a kind of repetitive desire to get developers together. And all we did was we kind of kept running with that question of like, what's next? And for us, that seemed obvious. It was like, let's just find a way to get developers together more often. Pleb Lab spawned. When we started Pleb Lab, we kind of got really lucky that I had orange-pilled the VP of operations at the Capital Factory. And they gave us like a 3-month trial period for free with a 10-person office space. And knowing full well that like we were not an accelerator program, we had like an idea that what we could put together inside of a physical space with founders and really brilliant devs was something similar to an accelerator. But we also knew that we were not an accelerator. We were 3 plebs with a 10-person office and a belief that we could help people. And what we did with the guys like John and everybody else who came into that first cohort, if you will, was we basically gave it away with the idea that like over time we could find a way to trend towards a business model and a deeper understanding of what we do. And that's kind of where we're at now. As time has gone on, we went through, I mean, you were in some of the conversations back and forth with me, kind of helping me piece it all together. But like we went through dozens, if not hundreds, of iterations of like how to kind of explain the business model that we have here. And what we've kind of alluded to today is that we are an accelerator program kind of rebuilt for the Bitcoin era. And for 2 reasons. It was rebuilt because necessity. We were not like a $1 billion exit CEO who just like wanted to start a Bitcoin accelerator program with like fun money. But also because it actually seemed to us necessary to kind of reimagine the accelerator program for the Bitcoin era, because this is not a new technology. It's the new technology. And I think that there's value in the accelerator models of the past, but I think for the way that Bitcoin's being built, with it being free and open source, there's a lot of nuances in this technological era that are significantly different than Web 2. And we've really tried to take an approach that kind of reorients an accelerator program to make more sense for the startups we work with today. So basically, some of the differences that we see right now are that we don't do cohorts. I use the term for lack of like really a better term. When we find rock stars who are building really cool things, if they're ready to work with us, we're ready to work with them. We will start day one as soon as they show up. We also don't really have end dates. We will work with you as long as you want to work with us. Our kind of goal is a first round of fundraising. So we include free access to our space and all of our resources for as long as it takes to get our startups funded. After that, we hope that they want to stick around and continue to add brain power and understanding of the ecosystem for entrepreneurship for the next group of people coming through. But yeah, it's basically like indefinite assistance, because really what we've built here isn't just like a business model. It has become a business, but really it's a group of friends who care about one another and want to see each other and the Bitcoin ecosystem succeed. And I think that's probably the biggest difference between us and the kind of fiat competition accelerator programs of the past. What we do also, Matt, is like we have a kind of umbrella program. We kind of know like where we get started and kind of how to roadmap towards the end of the fundraising. But we also tailor every single approach to the founder's needs with where they are as a founder and a company when they come through the door, because each and every founder has a different set of skills and a different set of needs when they come to us.
Yeah, I think awesome. just to piggyback what Kyle's saying, I think the biggest thing that we found out, Matt, over the course of, you know, a year at this point doing this is that each person, each individual, each Bitcoiner, each founder is different. And they're different in like a lot of different skill sets, but a lot of different paths of where they are in their life and in their company's life. And what we try to do is just really look at it from a how can we help perspective, and then we get them plugged into the people that they need help with, right? And then we even do one better where we try to really game plan like a rollout, kind of like an entryway to launching their company. I've come to realize that doing it that way, especially with Bitcoiners, is just the easier way and more natural way to do it, as opposed to forcing people in a cohort and forcing them to, you know, get done by a certain time. Like, sure, that works, but where we're located inside of Austin, it's not really Austin-y, I should say, like, to do that. It's more Austin's kind of very laid back and chill, and it's a like the city that we're in plays a big role in how we kind of run the accelerator right now. I would say, I don't know if Kyle believes that, but I certainly see it. You look at a lot of the Austin mainstay companies here, it's a very relaxed environment, and people like to work hard, but they also like to relax.
Well, I think just also the other thing that is kind of something that we do here with the program that we've put together, and you touched on it, I think, before we started recording, Matt, is that we're really scrappy because we had to be. We're aiming to assist startups while ourselves being a startup. And that has had a profound effect on our own kind of critical thinking about how to operate. We're not giving startups $250,000. We're not flying them halfway around the world and putting them up in lodging. But what we are doing is giving them our blood, sweat, and tear equity. Like, we're putting in literally everything we have every single day, and we are like, it's not just proof of work. It's like compounding proof of work. The people who are in the program today, like our first round of like the official accelerator program in PlebLab phase two, we've seen tremendous growth and kind of like ease, if you will, relative to the first cohort, because not only have we learned a lot about what we're doing, but we also have a ton of other people around who have learned a lot about this space. And we're all kind of compounding that proof of work over and over and over again. And it just kind of gets exponentially better.
Yeah, you're building with them. You're almost a peer in the building process.
Yes, correct. I mean, there was some real challenges in that model in the beginning, because we brought in a couple of founders and we brought in a couple of really smart people like Tony Giorgio here in the chat. And like, as we were a peer in the process ourselves, kind of like on the brink regularly of kind of like, okay, how are we going to pay the bills next week? How are we going to pay the bills next month? There were some real struggle points where it was like, okay, we're actually kind of pushing people away with this energy of like kind of doom and gloom on a regular basis. And it took a long time to work through that. I think in the long run, it strengthened all of us because we all had to kind of go through the same struggles together, and we've come out stronger for it on the other side.
Well, all that is great, but Tony wants to know if you can play his PlebLab build with Liquid.
I don't know. Do you take you take Liquid on Zep, right? Right.
Yeah,
of course he does.
We don't take Liquid at PlebLab.
Sorry, Tony, rugged again. You're going to have to convert that Liquid BTC to regular Bitcoin. So another thing I wanted to touch on was something that we're also doing in Nashville, which, by the way, I hope the theme of this show is a budding and prosperous partnership between PlebLab and Bitcoin Park.
Absolutely. Just real quick, Matt, we've learned so much from y'all. Like going over there and hanging out with you and Rod and seeing how y'all do things, like, it's made us like more aware of like where we're failing, right? It's seeing the things that you guys do really, really well and like saying, how can we do the same thing at PlebLab? It's really learning from each other. And even seeing Terminus and seeing those guys in Atlanta and learning from them, it's going to take all of us to figure this out. Like, that's what I believe.
100%. But where I was going with it is, so we have been focused, we have two universities, Belmont and Vanderbilt, that are blocks away from Bitcoin Park. And we've had, you know, we're like starting various initiatives with those students. You guys mentioned UT, University of Texas, I guess all three of you went and presented there. How do you think about, I also saw a picture on Twitter of Kyle shirtless outside of one of the campus buildings. Like, how do you guys think about those initiatives and how that impacts Bitcoiners in general? I mean, getting this next generation into Bitcoin and interested.
Carr, you want to touch on that first?
Yeah, I think it's really simply just being there to answer questions. Right now, Topher is doing a really good job along with Dee to get more and more Bitcoin-focused education inside of UT. Me and Topher have discussed, you know, reaching out to ACC, which is our local community college, because I think there's a big need there, and it's probably an easier sell personally. I think in order to really get more Bitcoiners moved over from this like crypto space here in town is we have to hit the city. So that's going to be like one of the things that I focus. I've already started kind of moving in that direction already, but I think next year really going to start focusing in and on getting Bitcoin involved in the city in some segment, because right now I think a lot of these crypto companies kind of give them the wrong information. So I think it's just, I've realized that in order for PlebLab to become the Austin Bitcoin company that I foresee it becoming, we have to be more involved with our community here inside of the city, inside of the education space and stuff like that. And I think you guys are doing similar things in Nashville. So I think it's the way, I think.
I also think it's interesting because like we noticed kind of, I don't know, a while ago that they're just, one of the biggest challenges is that there just isn't enough builders. Like we want to see so many more builders. And for a while we were kind of on this thought wave of like, okay, how do we build more builders? And I actually think that building more builders is probably a good thing. And I would say that's the educational side of things. I think the other thing that we're kind of looking to try and do now is using UT, using Austin Community College, using our local tech and entrepreneurial meetups to actually not build new builders, but to facilitate better builders on a better ecosystem. Because there's actually a ton of builders in our local community. I think really what we just need to do is get out there and kind of introduce them to Bitcoin in a way that makes sense for them to like want to come over and build on it. And I think our workshops, getting involved with like helping to launch classes at UT, and then just really getting out there and talking with people on like a one-on-one basis at the tons and tons of meetups around the city are some of the ways we're kind of looking to approach that right now. So it's some level of like building new builders, but then also kind of facilitating just like a knowledge base inside of a group of builders that are already technical and really just trying to help them understand why it makes sense to come over and build on Bitcoin.
It's very similar to the model that we did for Austin Bitcoin Club, where you just need to be a platform, right? You don't need to be heavy-handed with the PlebLab sales pitch. And I think time and time again that kind of pathway has worked for us time and time again. So we're just going to keep, you know, using that kind of tool to do it. And I think people will see the light and they'll know where to go. I believe that.
Love that framing. I agree 100%. So where do you guys want to go with this? We're about 55 minutes in. I basically asked everything I wanted to touch on. You guys have anything you want to touch on?
Yeah, I think Kyle wanted to talk about this article that he sent over to Bitcoin Magazine. You want to talk about that, Kyle?
Yeah, I mean, it's a good direction. I think one of the things that it touches on what I kind of just said with this idea of facilitating kind of like better builders on a better network is really starting to put out the signal or at least just kind of start talking about getting it out there in the discussion realm is this idea of Bitcoin transitioning into or having maybe already transitioned into what I'm calling the application era. I think what we've seen up until now is a lot of like really heavy focus on the like move slow and don't break things, the like the privacy, the security, the robustness of its network and its infrastructure. And I think where we're seeing things go now, it requires like a kind of conversation or several conversations to really figure out how things work as we move into this new era of like the things that aren't built on Bitcoin or in Bitcoin, but that are built on top of Bitcoin. This now allows us to actually start moving fast and breaking things. And I think one of our pleb devs in the space says it like this. He says, the introduction of the application era is how we move the network or introduce the network to the next billion users. And I think that's really true. So I think it's interesting to talk about what that looks like and where we think it goes from here.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense to me. There's definitely been, I've noticed a sea change in kind of the community of builders in the space in a positive way over the last maybe 3 years. And it's very noticeable with the Austin crew. Particularly like, I think a good example of it is massive friend of the pod, Michael Atwood, and how he approaches building out Oshi. He's very much on the ground all the time, connecting directly with users. I guess Keon would be a very good example with Stacker News. I felt like we really didn't have as much of that before. You know, maybe 5 years ago, 6 years ago, where like the founders were directly, the builders were directly interacting with the users to a larger degree. And particularly, I guess it always happened, but particularly new users, new Bitcoiners, people that are just coming into the space.
Yeah, I think it's an important it's an important transition in the space because like a lot of what already has been built, at least in my humble opinion, is like some of it really doesn't scale much further without the growth of this layer. Voltage, I think, is a really great example of a company that scales significantly faster it's built for the growth of the application layer, right? Like the more people building applications on top of Voltage, like the more that infrastructure layer scales. And I think that's probably not the only example. Like a lot of these infrastructure things that have been put in place, the way to accrue more value to them is to get more people building. And that when those people build, it's like the growth of that user base grows as well. I think if you look back at Web 2.0, it's like the same thing, right? Like the internet was a great discovery or invention as well, right? But it didn't really start becoming that valuable until email. And like all of the things, the applications that got built on top of the protocol started entering into like the realm of usability, right? Like it's, everybody always talks about like, when is it going to be like usable? When can like grandma use it? Like all of these kind of questions about the next round of users. Well, that comes from the application. It's the people who are building kind of unique use cases across that protocol. That's really what I think is going to help scale up the next round of users to Bitcoin. It's the people who will kind of get it through the monetary lens, through the kind of revolutionary lens. I think a lot of the purists, if not most of the purists, are kind of already here, right? And now it's going to just get people involved through kind of very similar use cases as the way the internet got more and more users.
Yeah, I'd 100%
agree with that. I'll let you go in a second, John, but we got Tony in the comments. He posted one of my favorite memes, which is the just use Voltage button, where it's like you can have Voltage do all the heavy Bitcoin lifting on the back end when you just have an app that interfaces directly with what they have. John, go.
Yeah, well, actually, just I was going to touch briefly on what Kyle said, but it also ties into what you just said as well about building applications on top of things like Voltage that is good. I mean, like, I can't wait to get like some really, really awesome integrations done with Voltage. Like we're talking and working on some stuff that's like, you know, I think is going to be like really cool in the future. But this was one of the, you know, the main reasons about why I started Zaparate in the first place was because I started it because it came out of a need that I had. I just needed an invoicing app because I was a contractor and I was earning Bitcoin and I needed to send, you know, professional invoices to companies. So it came out of that personal need. And then obviously, like, I thought, well, we're going to need more of these applications as Bitcoin grows out. And I think Kyle is like right. And I've heard him talk about this quite a lot about, you know, we're reaching that application layer stage where a lot of new businesses are going to be built up, which abstract away a lot of the stuff that these amazing like Bitcoin and Lightning developers have been doing for the last few years and removing, you know, a lot of the complexity. Like they've built these really great tools like Voltage, and then we can bring in like, you know, designers and UI, UX people like myself and others to build startups on top of that again, which just bring it and expand it out to like that little bit more of a market, right? And just make it a little bit more accessible, and just bit by bit we'll just slowly creep out and start pulling in more of the traditional markets that you know, we all know eventually like that things are going to like move over onto Bitcoin and Lightning, and particularly in the payments area, but obviously like it has a lot more applications as well. But yeah, I mean it's really amazing as a founder. I mean, we talked about the benefits of PlebLab and what that did for me and Zaparate, but also just having tools like Voltage there as well. I'm not a traditional developer, so I can't, you know, build my own Lightning implementation.
Voltage is a perfect example with you, because I remember our original call, the reason Liquid was even being brought up was because Liquid is by design federated model, so it is it's custodial, but it's multi-sig custodial, so the risk of the custodian is reduced and minimized. But as a result of the trade-offs Liquid has made, it's very easy for an app developer to integrate Liquid where they're not holding custody of the user funds and the user has a relatively seamless experience. Lightning was not the case, and I remember during that conversation we had, I don't think Voltage existed yet, or it wasn't that big yet. But we kept going back to, I was like, I know you want to keep it self-custody so that you don't do KYC. And that's a key aspect of the value prop and reduces user friction in terms of convenience. But how do you do self-custody Lightning in an easy way for users? And now all of a sudden you have Voltage and you're able to basically send that user to Voltage, maybe have them plug in some kind of API key or something into Zaparate, and all of a sudden they can accept Lightning payments without you having to take custody of funds.
Yeah, absolutely. There's so many amazing things that we can do. And yeah, I mean, you're right. The goal with Zaparate from the start has always been self-custody and no KYC, as long as is like, you know, possible in this, you know, market that we're entering into. And if we can keep building those tools where there's really easy UI UX applications like Zaparate that have these deeper integrations into things like Voltage. And then you can, you know, simply, like you said, have these one click onboarding processes where people can spin up nodes where they still get control of the nodes. They have their access to their Voltage dashboard if they need, but we've got some like mini UI stuff within Zaparate that we can do. And we can have like really cool integrations where you send out an invoice and we know like that you're expecting X amount of sats for this invoice. And we can say like, oh, well, you need that inbound liquidity on Voltage. So how about like, you know, we give you some of our liquidity and we use Voltage's Flow API and we do all kind of like deeper integrations like that, which just abstract away a lot of that stuff and get it to that grandma stage as Kyle talks about. Is like we just need to build a lot of the front end stuff that, like I said, piggybacks on top of the absolutely stellar work that's been done over the last few years on at the protocol level.
So, well, since grandma keeps getting brought up, I just want to say, like, yes, our grandmas can currently use, to a degree, you know, Signal and iMessage and email. it's important to realize that when email was first created, those grandmas all have died. So we're really, when someone says we're like building for the grandmas, it's really like the people that are not quite grandmas yet, or they're about to become grandmas.
It would be grandmas.
Yeah, future grandmas.
Future grandma.
Another thing too, Matt, is like a lot of this stuff is like infrastructure at this point, right? Like you got Voltage, you got IBEX, you got Start. Like you have a lot of infrastructure pieces already there. Now you just need more people building on top of it and plugging into it. And that's where I think like a Plub Lab can help, is because we're seeing individuals come from different business sectors and they're looking to get into the Lightning or the Bitcoin space, but they don't know about the IBEXs, the Voltages and the Start Nines and all those infrastructure companies that are being platforms for anybody out there. And I think that's the biggest thing I think that Plub Lab can help with, is that facilitation to those things. I think we're early, but I do think like, man, we're there. We're on that tipping point.
So I've got a question. I mean, I'm going to phrase it the way Carr does, but do you mind if we get a little bit spicy here?
We love spicy on Dispatch.
Okay,
our sponsors can't cancel us because our sponsors are our listeners.
Fantastic. So it's I know this will probably get me somewhat attacked by a particular group of people, but it's a message that I had probably almost a year ago when we kind of started this thing. But I think to some extent, it's beyond Pleb Labs. Pleb Lab can help facilitate a lot of the kind of growth on an individual level for the builders that we work with. But again, coming back to this kind of reality that there aren't enough builders and that we're like looking to grow out the network of builders, I think it's important that we kind of like reframe some of the kind of language that we've seen in the space for a while now, with this idea of like the way that we attack individuals who are kind of in the phase of their journey that's still shitcoinery. I think obviously we want to call out shitcoinery. We want to call out shitcoins. We want to call out the scammers. But I think for the like probably the bulk work of people who find themselves building there, they're just people and they're trying to find a way to build something valuable and they're trying to find a way to like provide for themselves. And I think kind of attacking those types of people instead of like being open-minded enough to allow for a discussion and to present them with the thoughts on why Bitcoin is better and why they could and should be building on Bitcoin. I think that's really important for the Bitcoin community at large, is to like really start kind of trying to transition the way we discuss Bitcoin versus building on shitcoins with that particular group of people, because it's a really large group of people and they're technical and they want to build things. So I think yelling, fuck you, you looked at the word Ethereum on a computer screen today, is not really benefiting the growth of the application space. And I think we should probably try to do something about that.
I had a conversation about this other day, because we're thinking about, you know, how I do a lot of consulting work for Bitcoin Magazine, and I basically lead their open source initiatives over there. And we were thinking about, where does Bitcoin Miami, and the, like last year we had a 2,000 person open source stage dedicated to open source contributors, and it was basically 3 days of in-person Sill Dispatch.
That was sick.
We were thinking like, what do we want to do this year? And the topic came up, do we want to basically encourage shitcoin builders to switch over to Bitcoin? And then the question came up, well, how would the perception be among the Bitcoin community of that as a plan? And I do think there's a element here that is, you kind of have to separate Bitcoin Twitter from real life. And a perfect example is
100%.
Someone who I consider a friend, Seth for Privacy. He's focused on Bitcoin privacy, but he's also focused on Monero. And because he's focused on Monero, He's, you know, often he has a very, there's a lot of animosity with him in the Bitcoin Twitter community. And so I invited him down to Bitcoin Park, came to Bitcoin Park. He spent 2 days with us, 2 days with our local community. He had Zeus connected to his own node, Lightning node. He made his first in-person Lightning payments in our coffee shop. He kept trying to pay us more money than he owed us because he was trying to get the Lightning payments to fail and they weren't failing. He left with like a cold card, an open dime, some swag, super excited. He goes on to Twitter. He tweets out. He's like, I just had the most positive experience with the Nashville Bitcoin community. Like, it's made me completely change how I think about Bitcoin and how I want to contribute to Bitcoin. And then he immediately got hit by like 5 dozen responses calling him a shitcoiner. So that's the reality of the situation.
And so this is where I think, and I've talked about this with Tony, I've talked about this with like a bunch of people, is like, it's, I think it's important for people with a platform, people with like a voice like yourself, Matt, where it's like, to some extent, like, I think what happened with toxic maximalism, if you will, on Twitter in particular, is like, it stems from the right place. It stems from a bunch of intelligent people like yourself, like Tony, like Francis Poyo, like these guys who understood deeply the ideals behind why privacy and security matter and like the security model of Bitcoin. But I think what happened over time is that more and more and more people flooded into like the online space. The kind of message for like an actual articulated version of why it's important and like what you should do to contribute just kind of morphed into less articulate. And that's where we find ourselves today, is this like this ideal set makes sense, but the way that we're presenting the ideas around it doesn't. It's just a bunch of people yelling at one another and kind of killing off anybody that presents a possible future as a builder in Bitcoin. And I think it's a detriment to the space and the growth of the space. And that's why I really think the people with a platform and with a voice, it's like, we need to like take that hit and like maybe get attacked on Bitcoin Twitter more often to like really put out the message that it's like, look, man, this narrative, the way that we're presenting the narrative, is no longer beneficial for the space.
I don't, you know, I will push back a little bit on that because I think it's just inherent to Twitter. I think Twitter incentivizes simplicity in the extremes. And I would not go as far as saying that Bitcoin Twitter is a detriment. I think it's a massive net benefit compared to what we had in the past, particularly because there is reach among mainstream audiences rather than us just being in the Bitcoin Reddit or IRC or Bitcoin Talk. I think there's my favorite word, nuance. There's nuance here because really, so like another example is Rockstar. And Rockstar Dev, when he came in, like, and came into the space in more of a public way, he got into a big argument with, I think, specifically Francis and about BTC Pay and Litecoin support. And I defended Rockstar at the time. But the thing is like, I mean, Litecoin's a complete shitcoin. But the thing is it requires... There are malicious shitcoiners that do not adequately or intentionally ignore disclosing trade-offs and do so in an unethical way. And those people need to be called out strongly, publicly, and routinely. There's also Bitcoiners that do that, and they should also be called out. And then there are people that mean well and are trying their best and, you know, try to stand with like a relatively ethical code and disclose trade-offs here and there. And those people should be, you know, treated with a level of respect, and hopefully they come and build on Bitcoin. But for most people, that takes too much critical thinking. And Twitter is, you know, incentivizes simple, extreme comments. If you do the odds, if you're an asshole, if you're an asshole to the majority of public shitcoiners, most of them, you know, probably, I don't want to say deserve it, but probably had it coming. And it's good. And they're probably going to block you right away, which proves the point, right? Because they don't want any kind of dissenting opinion there. And there's a lot of gaslighting on that side of things. But I would say Bitcoiners aren't immune to that either. We have a lot of Bitcoin so-called thought leaders that basically took the lessons of 2017 and took the wrong lessons from them and thought, you know, the Bitcoin community should be more like shitcoin community.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of nuance there. I think ultimately then it's like, I think the idea of like showing respect to the people who will also show respect, it like that is maybe perhaps where I think we could try to do a little bit better. But ultimately, I think you're right. Like the way that it's just sad because Twitter is one of the largest platforms, if you will, for kind of voicing and sharing the Bitcoin kind of message. So having a lot of it get really kind of loud and noisy is somewhat distracting, I think, but maybe it's not a detriment. And then I think ultimately it just comes back to what you've already said with like how you did what you did in Nashville, which brings us right back to the focus on just like being intelligent, calm, and collected people in real life and like showing the value of the community in person, in your home.
Yeah, I mean, it's been something that I've noticed with the podcast, and I've kind of taken it over to my community initiatives, which is like the way this thing scales is not one person hitting 10 million people with education or anything. It's really individuals connecting with 10 people, 20 people, 100 people, and then those people going out and connecting with 10 people, 20 people, 100 people. And it's been it's such a positive and rewarding experience seeing that in person. Basically, all these grassroots communities popping up around the world. And it's just this domino effect, right? It's like you show kindness and respect and acknowledgement to other people, and then they go and they repeat that, and then they repeat that, right?
Yeah, it's interesting too, like, I think I learned it from Marty early on, because I was really hard in the paint kind of Bitcoiner for a long time. But I forget what we were talking about one time. Marty had said, like, you know, sometimes you just need to give a soft touch, right? Where you just kind of like what you said, Matt. It's just like you talk about Bitcoin, you let them, you inform them, you don't attack them, you attack the idea, and then you send them on their way. And then another Bitcoiner comes along the way and then gives another soft touch. And then it just kind of, you know, trampolines and becomes a thing, and they become a Bitcoiner. I think that's the way. I think if we all just give soft touches and educate and attack the idea, I think that's how we get them to become a Bitcoiner over time.
Yeah, I mean, I'm strongly of the belief that we build the education and the tools to empower individuals, and then when those individuals finally realize that they have the need, because everyone does have the need for Bitcoin, they just don't realize yet, they will come and seek them out. And so I have a love-hate relationship with this concept of orange pilling specifically. But because it does have its place when you see that there's a moment in time that maybe truly highlights the need for Bitcoin. But I think most people kind of just come to it on their own. And those people are way more susceptible to be in it long term for the right reasons rather than for gambling or quick riches. Like the type of people that often are almost forcibly orange-pilled or aggressively orange-pilled are the type of people that usually get wrecked in a bear cycle and disappear for 4 years, maybe come back later.
So can I ask you a question, Matt? On like the conversation around that very idea, like what do you think would be some like actionable ideas for, like, I think you're right. I think it's going to happen regardless and naturally, and people are going to find more and more that they like need Bitcoin. And I think having those tools and resources ready, like a Pleb Lab for those who find they want to build, but beyond just creating the space and then like sitting around, what are like actionable ideas to help accelerate the growth of more builders in this space?
Well, I mean, with builders specifically, I think it's a slightly different scenario than like an average Bitcoin user. And that scenario is mostly like they're obviously already intending to build or building in somewhere else, right? And that's making it clear that there's an opportunity for them to work on something that maybe is significantly more meaningful than they're currently working on, but also that they can be very successful doing, right? It's just, it's a different demo than like let's be honest, right? Like if we're in a hyper Bitcoinization scenario and we have 8 billion people using Bitcoin, technicals aside, like what percent of those are actually going to be builders? And that's probably going to be significantly less than 0.5%. So it's a very niche demo that has, you have to have a specific kind of support situation for those people, right?
Yeah. And I mean, again, that's kind of, it's what we're trying to do at PlebLab, and perhaps roadmapped out for Bitcoin Park and the other places springing up around the world, like looking to create a space and access to resources for those technical folks. It's just interesting because it's kind of like a, almost like a chicken and an egg thing, right? Where you're like talking about what percentage will be builders when we're in a hyper Bitcoinized world with 8 billion people on Bitcoin. But at the same time, it's like, we don't get to an 8 billion people hyper Bitcoinized world without more builders before we get there.
Yeah, 100%. We got Tony in the comments saying, I'm biased, but builders need sats. They already have talent, conviction, motivation, etc. No, I agree with that. Part of the reason why I helped build 1031 and OpenSats, two different sides of the same coin, really. It was just getting funding to builders. I'm curious. I mean, you guys threw you, I guess it was a partnership with Base 58. You guys threw that builder-focused event. What were the takeaways on that? What was it called? BTC plus plus?
Yeah, it was a Bitcoin plus plus. I think the takeaways we learned was that I think people are tired of these regular conferences. It needs to be like kind of like where it has both ends of the spectrum. Kind of what you guys did in Miami, where it has like the open source part, but it also has the other panel part. I think there's a need for education focused Bitcoin conferences. And I think we're going to see that trend in 2023 for sure. I think there's going to be a lot more. I know Nifty and the team at Base 58 are throwing the one in Mexico City here in December. So definitely go check that out. And then at some point next year, she's going to throw the Bitcoin Plus Plus again. So yeah.
It's and bullish. Of course we have TabConf that just happened. There's also not just like on the builder side, but just in general, I mean, as Bitcoin grows, there's still going to be a place for these large, you know, 25,000 person festival type events. But I think there's increasingly a desire and they end up being very productive, these smaller high signal events. And obviously you guys have been focused on that. We've been focused on that at Bitcoin Park. Parker and team have been focused on that over at the Commons. But I think we see more and more high signal, smaller events where people can have like unbridled discussion with other peers, right? Like actually off the record conversations. So many of our conversations nowadays are on the record and essentially public. And I know I say that on air, but it's great to have a place where you can actually talk without necessarily the pressure of a surveillance state and the pressure of public eye.
Yeah, that was actually like just bringing it back to PlebLab. Like that was one of the things that I really enjoyed when I first got in there, was just the discussions that we had among, you know, people that were in there from various different topics. You know, sitting in the same room as, you know, Tony and Paul from Voltage and Super Testnet and, you know, everybody else in there with just like so many different skill sets and experiences. You know, being able to have those kind of candid discussions, especially for a newbie who was just kind of like figure his way out in this whole like Bitcoin like space, it was huge. It was like, it was fundamental to my early growth anyway, as a founder and as a Bitcoiner who was, you know, in the background for a long time, and then trying to kind of like step in, but trying to ask questions and have conversations that, you know, could be had like off air in a face-to-face environment is critical.
I think just to touch on that too, it's just getting a little bit personal, is like, it's been great to watch and see the growth of companies and of like all of that. I mean, that's kind of the business we're selling. But I think my favorite part about everything that we have here and everything that we've done here has just been to watch and see the tremendous personal growth of the people in this community. And I know for me personally, it's really inspired a lot of my own personal growth. I've seen so much change in the community around me from Carr and what he learned with you guys over at TFTC and RHR and just all of it. Just it's been really tremendous to grow as like a family and to watch how we've all come up in not only the space, but just in our own kind of growth personally. It's been great.
Yeah.
It does really feel more like a family than an industry, at least in our little microcosm.
Yeah. I was just having a coffee with somebody over this past weekend, or maybe it was weekend before, and we were kind of talking about that. And man, that's like, for me, the biggest thing, Matt. And, you know, like, I really care about the people around me and I really want them to succeed. And like, for me, that's all that really matters. I know that's kind of like a weird concept. Yeah. Imagine
the bear market. It's the bear market cliche. Like, the real gains are the friends we made along the way.
Yeah. And me and Paul have talked about it. We're going to record a pod at some point to talk about it more, but like it really is like the Bitcoin price and all that stuff is there and it's in the back of your head, but it's not the motivator for me anymore. Like it used to be in the early days. It's definitely the people and the impact that I can have in a positive way in their lives. I think that's the thing that really gets me up in the morning, you know? I know it does that for you too, Matt.
So. Damn right. I also want to get wealthy, but that keeps me going. The cool part about Bitcoin is that that's aligned.
Yeah. Also, to talk about that conference in Europe at the Bitcoin Magazine through, somebody came in yesterday. I won't dox them, but they had nothing but great things to say about the European conference. Like, they were just like ecstatic. About it. So.
The cool part about that one was that it was mostly Europeans. I was mostly faces I hadn't seen. I spoke to freaks and people that I follow on Twitter and stuff that I just never met before. A lot of local Dutch people. The Dutch community was extremely strong. That was the coolest part to me. And I just love Amsterdam as a city.
Yeah, I wanted to go so bad, but it was like, I had to choose. Like, that was the biggest thing.
Yeah. I mean, it's... The darkness surrounding it is that it was at the same time as TabConf, but it was with an Amsterdam partner, and they were going to throw the event regardless, and those dates were locked in. So, but yeah, I was really disappointed not to go to TabConf, and that obviously personally bothered me. I reached out to Tidwell individually before the information was out there publicly, tried to support him as much as I could, but... that's always be a dark spot on that event to me. But the highlight by far was that we had so many locals that came out that have never been to any of the American events. And that was awesome. And also, it was a smaller event. It was a smaller event than the Miami event. And it goes back to what we were saying earlier. There was a workshop stage that was very intimate, that was focused on helping people build in the space. BTC Pay gave a great presentation. IBEX gave a great presentation there. So definitely want to see more of that. And I think the team at Bitcoin Magazine is very much aligned in that regard. So, I mean, I want to go off of what Carr said. You know, a common meme in this space is that bear markets are for builders. How do you guys feel about that meme?
I think it's true. So it's interesting because like just like talking with normies, like the occasional Uber ride or wherever I may be, and when I talk about the fact that I own a Bitcoin company, it's very common to be like, oh, that must be rough right now. And I've kind of had this pretty quick response most of the time where it's like, actually no, it's been pretty good for business. Like, because I think one of the things that at least with what we're doing that we've found is that like, it's actually a lot easier to find good talent in that bear market because there's so much less noise. And when money's not like sloshing around and frothy and everybody has access to it, you tend to find exactly what we are looking for. And what we tend to look for is disciplined leadership and a dedicated team. And those two things are really easy to find when it's a bear market, because like there's no money and they're still sitting there grinding it out day in and day out with a passion. So I think it's true. I think it seems to be like an accurate statement.
Yeah. I mean, personally, I definitely agree with that because I just know from my own experience that that's exactly what I'm doing at Zaprite. You know, it's been the last few months have just been, you know, head down grinding hard, like trying to get a lot of work done. And, you know, there's probably a lot of companies that are going through tough times right now. I mean, we know that in the mining space for sure, but there's probably other Bitcoin companies as well. I mean, I guess I was lucky enough in that I managed to raise a small pre-seed round, like just before the kind of deep bear market set in. So, you know, it gave me that runway to start building, but I see it everywhere. I certainly see it a lot from a lot of the other founders in PlebLab. They're doing the same thing. And one thing I wanted to touch on as well is that, you know, Matt, you mentioned like Michael Atwood from Oshi earlier. You know, one of the things that, you know, I talk a lot to Michael about, and I know he's super passionate about, is just that like the inter-founder collaboration as well. I mean, I don't know if this is like a normal thing in founder worlds in like, you know, fintech or any other like, you know, industry that goes on, but we just tend to talk a lot about how we can actually help each other's company, how we can actually like, you know, collaborate and build together and build tools that one person can use. And, oh, you need this. Well, maybe if I build it into my platform, we can link together and then we can like give your users this added benefit and this experience. And there's a lot of collaboration between us to try and figure out how we can streamline and optimize our work. You know, particularly so that we're not like repeating things and doing the same things over and over. If one founder can do one thing to help another founder, like we always do it. And we have a lot of those conversations. So that's one thing that I noticed within it as well, which I just thought was really curious to me being a first time founder. But I think it's huge. And I love that aspect of it.
Yeah, I mean, I got to notice that in person. We had our venture fund 1031, we hosted all of our founding teams for a private retreat where they can collaborate. And in the van, John and Michael were sitting behind me and they wouldn't shut up about collaborating on different things, which was great to see. You just want to you want to see as much collaboration as possible because a rising tide lifts all boats here in the Bitcoin space. I would just add on the bear markets are for builders thing. You know, if you look back, most of the successful companies have, you know, either grown in a bear market or were straight up launched in a bear market. But I would say that it's a little bit of selection bias because bear markets destroy the majority of builders. And Bitcoin as it is a survival of the fittest kind of game. And it really, the bear markets are when people realize why it's survival of the fittest. So the builders that survive a bear market and keep moving forward and keep putting one foot in front of the other and don't stop, usually see massive success. We just don't see the ones that the many that don't do that.
Disciplined leadership, dedicated teams. And also, Matt, the retreat you guys threw sounded pretty epic. So Grant, Jonathan, the rest of you guys, looking forward to participating in the next one.
You've never been the most subtle person, Kyle.
I try.
That kind of just really quickly, it was something that I think it kind of just brings up a couple of points. I mean, Matt, you mentioned earlier about, when we're talking about conferences and, you know, there is a place for the bigger public events, but sometimes the smaller high signal events are where a lot of stuff gets discussed and progress gets made. That event, 1031 event you're talking about, was definitely one of those. But I just wanted to mention quickly as well is that, you know, seeing as we're talking about the builder mentality in the bear market, I think a lot of that wouldn't happen without folks like yourself and 1031 as well, who have that, you know, Bitcoin only ethos and have that low time preference support for Bitcoin founders. So I definitely just wanted to mention that and say I, on a personal level, absolutely like stoked that there are funds like that available for founders like myself who have that same ethos and will under no circumstance talk to any shitcoin VC or fiat VC. And that makes it really hard when you're trying to raise money. Like there's no way in hell I'm going to have Zaprite's logo on a VC portfolio page beside some like DeFi shitcoin program. Having you guys there and there's plenty of others. I think Vivek or somebody else put out a thread actually the other day about Bitcoin only like VCs. And there was a good like 15, 20 or more that kept getting added in the thread. And like, it's amazing to see. It's great. And it like, you know, talking about bear market builders, like that wouldn't happen without, 1031 and other Bitcoin only funds. So eternally.
Yeah, well, I appreciate that. And I appreciate you. And it's been great to see a lot of growth in that space. And it's also why I launched OpenSats, for tax deductible, tax-deductible, no-fee grants to open-source contributors, no strings attached. Also, 1031, we also do open-source grants with no strings attached. So just more funding in the space is great. I do think it's also going to be could be a long bear market for a lot of those funds as well. But I hope to see many of them succeed alongside us. What were you saying, Kyle?
No, I was just saying I jest, but to touch on the same thing that John was already touching on, it's great to see the growth of it. But like the guys like Grant and Jonathan, I've had several conversations back and forth with them. And I told Grant myself personally many a times, I think his like outlines in his investment thesis that have been put out in the public many times over, they resonate so closely with the way that we kind of view things here at PlebLab. And I think it's just really cool to see that the kind of focus on and the understanding of where this thing seems to be trending, it's like so it seems to be very unifying in a direction. And I think that's great because the more focused we can get in that direction, unified together, I think the more powerful we'll be.
100%. So, boys, we're at the hour 40-minute mark. I want to reiterate that this was a conversation a long time in the making, and I expect that it's just the start of many conversations. So we don't have to feel like we've gotten everything in here. But I think it's been a pretty fantastic conversation. I hope the freaks have enjoyed it. Do you have anything else you guys want to touch on before we wrap it?
Just the kitchen. That Elon brought.
one thing that I always like to finish up conversations on, because it's just been so important to me, and I mentioned it at UT recently as well, is just really if you're any kind of a Bitcoin founder or pleb that just wants to kind of get involved in any way. Like Bitcoin Twitter is great. All these online communities are great, but the only real way to like move forward and make meaningful progress is like just getting in amongst it in the Bitcoin community face to face, going to meetups, going to conferences, going to events, hackathons, workshops, and just like, you know, walking into places like PlebLab and saying, "Hey, I'm a Bitcoiner. Can I just park here for a day and work and have some conversations?" And you never know what might come out of it. So massive fan of the community building aspect of what Club Lab is doing, and just encourage a lot more people to really take advantage of that. If it's not available somewhere close to you, then start it up, make it available. It's easy to do. There's a roadmap for it. And it provides immense benefits to everybody. So definitely a fan of the in-person community meetups.
100% to that. Thank you, John. Kyle, final thoughts.
Yeah, I mean, it's very similar to what John just said, but maybe from the other side. And it's something that our attorney said at TabConf. I think my final thoughts would be, if you're out there, if you're a builder, if you're entrepreneurially inclined, you're thinking about trying to start a startup, there's never been a better time to go out and do that. Whether it be Pleb Lab or the growing number of people focused on the acceleration of Bitcoin startups, there's so many resources out there, and there are so many people who want to help you along your journey. So if you're thinking about it, I would say my final thought is just go do it.
Love it. Thanks, Kyle. Final thoughts, Carr.
Yeah, I would just say, if you're a Bitcoiner that has any skill set whatsoever, and you're looking to get plugged in, come to Pleb Lab, come to Bitcoin Park, come to these places, and you know, you'll get connected, and you can use that as a springboard, as a platform to really get your name out there. I see BTC Retriever in the comments. He says, much love to the plebs at Pleb Lab. He's somebody that we've helped, you know, just through the thing that we built here. And then also, I got a fun fact for you, Matt. You ready for this?
I love fun facts.
It's Noster November.
Noster November. But you're not practicing it.
Yes, I am. I'm off Twitter. I'm on Domus and Enigma. Let's go.
I thought I saw you tweet it.
Yeah, I tweeted it I think the day before on the 31st. So anyways, so
you want to explain what Noster November is?
Yeah. Noster November is a thing that was created by JB55. He made the Domus app. A lot of us here inside Pleb Lab were super excited about Noster. We got some guys trying to kill it and attack it. there's other guys that are trying to build on it. It's a lot of fun, and it's going to be really interesting to see if we can really make Noster take off here and help it grow much faster if we all stay on Noster for the whole November. So, yeah.
Well, we love Noster here at Dispatch. To the freaks who may have just recently joined us, there's a great conversation, episode 63. With both Fiat Jaff and JB55, two of the main guys behind Noster. So definitely go check that out. I want to thank Carr, Kyle, and John, our wonderful guests, for joining us again. I want to thank all the freaks who continue to support the show, whether that's joining in the live chat, joining in the constant Matrix chat, supporting the show through streaming sats, whether that's on Fountain, Breeze, or one of the other podcasting 2.0 apps, or supporting through a BTC Pay server. And once again, supporting by sharing the show, sharing Dispatch with your friends and family, subscribing on your favorite platform. I really do appreciate it. You guys keep me going. I have great shows lined up, really great conversations lined up for Dispatch in the coming weeks, including one with Barack over the most recent LND bug. So it should be a fun time, and don't let anyone tell you that Dispatch is dying or value for value doesn't work. We're going to prove them wrong. So I love you all. Stay humble, stack sats. Peace.
Thanks for having us, dude.
Thank you.
Thanks.